these biblical authors are literary geniuses. And what they have written is beautiful and highly artistic. And what that means is it demands a high level of rigor on our part if we want to really understand what they're saying. And it demands a shared worldview, categories, and symbolism.
Welcome back to the Resurrection Church Podcast. My name is Aaron Downs, and today I'm joined with a special guest, Tom Sculthorpe. Tom Sculthorpe is the Director of Math Education at Memoria Press. He serves as an elder at Kenwood Baptist Church at Victor Memorial in Louisville, Kentucky, where he's also Director of the Kenwood Institute. Tom has a PhD in Biblical Theology from the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Tom, welcome to our church podcast.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, so before we begin, you know, I'd be interested in you just telling us a little bit about yourself, your role at the church and Kenwood Institute, and maybe if you'd like, you could also share a little bit about what you wrote about for your PhD dissertation.
Sure. Yeah. So I'm originally from Michigan, so closer to you all than Louisville, and I do love the North. I'm a veteran of the U.S. Navy. I spent 10 years as a naval aviator. And then I became a Christian and later on I wanted to learn more about the Bible and I wanted to be a more useful and service oriented member of the church. And so I started taking classes at Southern Seminary from a distance, ultimately ended up going there to finish the master's program in person. I liked school and I wanted to learn a lot more. And I really liked Jim Hamilton, one of the professors there. And so we decided to stick around so I could do the PhD program. And I really enjoyed it, and I got everything out of it that I wanted to. And I would encourage, you know, anyone who's thinking along those lines, whether it's master's or higher, to consider coming to Southern in person and participating in it here. And you know, at Kenwood and the Kenwood Institute and what we're doing there. The dissertation that I wrote is interpretive and hermeneutical. So my main goal was to make a hermeneutical argument or a contribution to biblical interpretation and then demonstrate it by looking at the narrative in Genesis. So the thesis of my work was that Moses, who wrote the first five books of the Bible as a literary whole, so that's Genesis through Deuteronomy, he intended the birth of Isaac to function as a type of resurrection from death. And Isaac was born from barrenness. So, and that is an idea that he kind of inaugurates in Genesis. And Isaac isn't the only born from barrenness boy in the book. There's several of them, which is part of it. But that's an idea that gets picked up by later authors, namely Isaiah, and then also in the New Testament with the birth of John the Baptist and Jesus. So what I got to do was do a lot of specific textual work in the book of Genesis, and then look at how later authors interpreted it and developed it for their own purposes. The hermeneutical point I was trying to make was basically, it has to do with how we ought to read the Bible. And well, this is very relevant for your listeners and really for anyone who's interested in reading the Bible. We want to read the Bible according to what the authors intend and also in accordance with how it was given, which is progressively over time. And I can get more into that if you want, but that was basically it.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And it deals with a lot of what we'll be talking about today, just regarding a particular text here in Genesis. I think debates about how to interpret the Bible, what we're looking for, how to go about that. You know, these debates are all over the place. And we might sometimes think that just happens in seminaries, but it works itself out in churches as well. So it's important for us to think about that. And probably at our church, our members are seeing that done, hopefully well, as pastors preach and is sitting there in classes, but everyone's a reader of the Bible, so we should attend to these things. So we'll get into more of those ideas as we go, particularly the idea of typology and how to read the Bible. But I want to talk about your article that was put out in the Kenwood Bulletin in April called "Why Does Moses Call the Promised Savior a Seed? Resurrection Typology in Genesis 1 through 3. And I'm gathering that you are looking at 1 Corinthians, where it says that Paul says that Christ was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and you're trying to show us how Paul can make that statement is you look, and you're going all the way back to Genesis 1 to do that. So could you give us a brief explanation for why you would want to establish an Old Testament connection between resurrection and third day, and how that helps us understand 1 Corinthians to begin with?
Sure. So Paul's claim is that what happened with Jesus is according to the scriptures. He doesn't, in that context, point to a specific passage or verse or a particular author or book of the Bible. He just says, according to the scriptures. What he means by the scriptures at his time would have been the Old Testament. So it would appear to me that basically what he's saying is that according to the Old Testament, the Messiah would die and rise on the third day. And so I would say it's less about what I want to do and more exploring what exactly Paul means by that. So what if he's saying the whole Old Testament, which again is what he appears to be saying, what does he have in mind? What does that look like? And I want to go and kind of explore that by reading the Old Testament very closely. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think some people may look at the Old Testament and say, there really isn't resurrection in the Old Testament, or ancient Jews didn't really believe in the resurrection. So you're saying they did, and there are at least hints in the Old Testament that begin to teach this resurrection idea.
Yes, that's right. There was a consensus, early consensus for a long time that resurrection did not really arise in the Hebrew mind and in their worldview until Daniel's time, so post-exile. And they would point to things like Daniel 12:2, an explicit reference to an end-time resurrection. And then the controversies while Jesus was ministering between the Sadducees and the Pharisees having to do with the resurrection of the body. One of the things I found in my research is that there are a lot of evangelicals in the past several decades who are arguing that that's not the case, and that actually resurrection is a key component of the Hebrew worldview from the beginning of the Bible. And I would point to two sources in particular. One is Mitchell Chase, who is a professor at Southern Seminary and a pastor here in Louisville. He wrote his dissertation on this topic in 2013. And then also John Levinson, who has been a professor at Harvard, and he's a Jewish. And so his interpretive perspective is a little bit different than your common evangelical one, but still very helpful. And I learned a lot from both of those guys as I was working on what I was doing. But yes, and they're not the only ones. Like L. Michael Morales is another guy. He teaches at Greenville Seminary in South Carolina, and he's a pastor. He's arguing for the same thing, that things like Exodus and, again, birth from barrenness, which is what I focused on, these are all metaphors for resurrection from death, and they function to anticipate not only Jesus's resurrection, but the final resurrection when we all will be resurrected in the same way that he was.
Very good. And your purpose is to read the Bible with the aim of identifying the interpretive perspective of the biblical authors, or the communicative intention of the biblical authors. And in this article, you suggest that Genesis 1:1-2:3 provides the first window into a resurrection typology and its author intended. So could you talk to us a little bit about how you see that resurrection typology in Genesis 1:1-2:3 with special attention to the structure or the form of that text?
Yes. What I would commend interpretively is a focus on authorial intent. So what I would say is this: we want to read the Bible like we read any other book, which is, I want to understand what the author is trying to say to me as the reader. Now, granted, in our postmodern context, that's not how people typically read. Typically, we come to a text and we want to add meaning, or the meaning of the text is going to at least partially derive from what I'm going to bring to it as the reader. I would disagree with that and say, let's go back to postmodernism. But what I'm not saying is that the Bible is just like every other book, because it's not. It's inspired, but it's literature, and it's written by inspired human authors. It is unique in its authority and in its inerrancy, but it's not unique necessarily in the way that we ought to approach it as readers. So with respect to Genesis 1, essentially, we say Genesis 1, really the literary unit goes into the first several verses of chapter 2, which is very clear with these are the generations heading in verse 4. So the creation account is a 7-day account, right? So that's kind of one structural marker. The other one is there's a high degree of repetition. It's almost poetic. It's not. In the original language, it's very clearly prose, but it's so repetitive that it has a lot of poetic features to it. And so the structure of it is very easy to discern. You have the 7-day structure, and then the fact that creational activity is only happening on the first 6 days is the kind of the next step down from that. And then the fact that the story starts with formless and void and ends with Sabbath rest, when everything is essentially as it should be. But what I'm arguing is that what God does in the 6 creative days, culminating in the 7th Sabbath day rest, is that he's addressing the formless and void problem or problems. He forms and then he fills, so that the creation, the heavens and the earth, are no longer formless and void. And that Sabbath rest, again, is a well-formed and filled physical world in which every space has a proper ruler. And so the first 3 days address the forming problem. And what we see on days 1, 2, and 3 is this consistent separation of spaces. So we ought to conceive of light and darkness as spaces, which is strange for us. And this is, I'll just throw an aside in here on worldview. The worldview of the biblical authors is very different from ours as modern Westerners. So when we think of light and darkness, we think of a light source and we think of the absence of light. We think more scientifically, you might say, or observation-based. And for the Hebrews, though, it appears that when God created light and darkness and called them day and night, that they were spaces, and that later on day 4, he fills those spaces with the lights that we see. A common question is, how was there light before the sun was created? That's kind of a modern scientific question that Moses is not trying to answer. His point is to depict the creation of the world in a certain way. I mean, that's not saying he's making it up, right? I would argue that this is how it happened. But the point is that light and darkness are forms that are going to be filled. And then that's the same with the waters above and below, between which is the sky, and on day 2. And then on day 3, when the dry land is brought up from the midst of the waters, so that there's separation between dry land and the seas. All of that is creating spaces in the world that are then filled in the second group of 3 days. So think two parallel panels. On day 4, light and darkness are, day and night are filled with the greater light and the lesser light and the stars, and they rule over their respective spaces. And then on day 5, waters below and the sky are filled with fish and birds respectively, and God tells them to be fruitful and multiply, which again is ruling language. It's the same kind of thing you see with humans at the in chapter 1, verses 26 through 28. And then on day 6, you get the land animals followed by humans, so the inhabitants of the dry land. So that's kind of an overview. Now, there is parallelism between the days as you go, as I've just kind of laid out. Day 4 goes with day 1 because we fill day 1, and then day 5 goes with day 2, and then day 6 goes with day 3. And the unique thing about days 3 and 6 is that they both have kind of two halves to them. They're the only 2 days that have multiple "and God said" in the text. So multiple speaking creative acts on God's part. On day 3, the two are the dry land appear and then the vegetation, the seed-bearing plants. And then on day 6, it's the land animals followed by the humans. And so what I'm trying to highlight not only is a parallelism between days 3 and 6, but this apparent parallelism between seed-bearing plants or fruit-bearing trees, the things that grow out of the ground, and humans, which both occupy the second half of their respective days. And that what that leads me into is the reason why Moses, in his judgment on the serpent, says the one to come, the child of the woman to come, is a zarah. In the Hebrew, it's a zarah. It's a seed, which is an agricultural term. It's not a biological term, a procreative term. You put a seed in the ground, okay? So that's kind of my view on Genesis 1. As far as how that points to resurrection from death, it has to do with the nature of seeds, right? So again, we aren't agricultural people, most of us. We go to the store and buy food. We don't grow it, and it's not a big part of our lives. But for the Israelite audience to whom Moses is writing, this is an everyday lifestyle of theirs. They're constantly working the ground and drawing food out of it. And so this is a poignant image for them, I think. What do we do with a seed? It goes in the ground, and then days later, and this varies with particular seeds, but days later, life comes out of the ground, right? That's what seeds do. And I think that ultimately that's the answer to the question regarding the seed of the woman, is this human is going to do what seeds do. He's going to go in the ground, and then life is going to come out of the ground, which is exactly what the Lord Jesus does. And one of the things that keyed me off to this, and this often happens, I think, is we read statements in the New Testament and we kind of think, where did that idea come from? Well, John 12:24, Jesus says, unless a grain of wheat goes into the ground and dies, it cannot bear fruit. He's talking about himself, right? So he's talking about himself, a human, as a seed, a grain of wheat to be specific. And he's talking about going in the ground and then coming out of it, which is what seeds do. So what I'm saying is, I don't think that Jesus made that up on the spot. I think that he's doing two things. One is he's giving a poignant image at the worldview level that would make sense to his audience. And number two, he's doing it in accordance with what was written in the Old Testament, namely, again, in the early chapters of Genesis.
Okay, so let me summarize and you tell me if I have correct what you're arguing here. So you're saying, kind of following the poetic-like literary structure of Genesis 3, where you have a column of 3 days that addresses the forming problem, that's mirrored by days 4 through 6 addressing the filling, the emptiness problem. On day 3, you have seed-bearing plants created in this kind of double act of creation. That's the second creative act. And then in the mirror column on day 6, humans as a second act of creation are created in parallel. So you have a linkage between seed and humans there. And then there's another connection between seeds and the third day, because seed-bearing plants are made on the third day. And then when God promises the seed of the woman, you're saying that the image that might come to mind is that of a seed that would go into the ground, and with this linkage on the third day of the seed-bearing plants, there's the beginning of this picture of resurrection in connection with third day. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Great summary.
Okay. So I found that really interesting when I read it. And my first thought was, this seems like good sensus plenior or figurative reading. But as I kept reading your article, you identify this guy who's saying something somewhat similar to you, but he's suggesting that you can only arrive there if you read the Bible figuratively, or identifying maybe a spiritual interpretation here or something. But you seem to argue that you don't need to read figuratively, you're just reading literally. So to enter into this discussion, maybe you could say a few things about figural interpretation or typology, and then help us understand your claim that you're not offering a typological reading, you're just reading a typology that's intended by the author.
Okay, I'm going to start with a phrase you used earlier, which is the interpretive perspective of the biblical authors, which is Dr. Hamilton's definition of biblical theology. So in other words, this is how we want to read the Bible. We want to read it with a view to authorial intent, right? Which means that I am not adopting a particular reading strategy when I come to the scriptures. As I said earlier, I'm just reading it like any other literature. And I'm going to do so paying close attention to the literary features of the text that the author uses. So this is a common misconception, I think, in interpretation broadly, is if there are metaphors in a text, say, or if a text is allegorical, if I read it attuned to those metaphors or attuned to the allegory, I'm not reading the text allegorically or metaphorically. I'm reading it in line with the author's intent. In other words, I'm reading it literally. That's what literally means, is to read in accordance with the author's intent. I'm not reading it literalistically. That would be to ignore poetic and literary devices and take every word at its kind of concrete base meaning face value. That's not what I'm advocating for. So the discussion around typology in particular would be, is typology a feature of the text, or is it an imposition on the text? But what I mean by that is, am I going to read the text typologically, or am I going to read the text according to the author's intent? And if he intends typology, I'm going to elucidate that or include that in my interpretation. And my answer to that question, in line with others like Dr. Hamilton, and Ardell Kanaday has a good chapter on this. I learned a lot from him in there's a Feshrif volume for Dr. Schreiner at Southern It's called God's Glory Revealed in Christ. And he's got a chapter in there on this, that typology is, if it's valid, it's an inherent feature of the text. It's author intended and it's divinely inspired. And it's providential because these are things that actually happened. So I know like it can come across like, oh, you're just making this stuff up. No, what I'm trying to do is argue for it textually. And you read my article. If you read it, I'm making text-based arguments for my thesis. And in so doing, I'm trying to say the author intends for us to see this metaphorical connection. My claim is subject to critiques regarding validity, and I'm happy to hear those. That's what's interesting and fun about biblical interpretation is conversations around validity. Well, I think the text means this. Why do you think that? Well, this is, and this. Okay, great. Well, I'm going to call that point right there into question and back and forth. You know, that's how we work these things out. So, but yeah, my goal is not to impose on the text a particular meaning or reading strategy. It is to draw out of the text the author's intended meaning. And, you know, these biblical authors, we have a tendency in our day to kind of reflect on the past in a condescending way. These biblical authors are literary geniuses. And what they have written is beautiful and highly artistic. And what that means is it demands a high level of rigor on our part if we want to really understand what they're saying. And it demands a shared worldview, categories, and symbolism. So again, does an agricultural metaphor like seed jump out at us? Not really, because we don't deal with that every day. It's not a part of our lives. Does it make sense to us to think about waters below and above? Like to think about the clouds in the sky as waters? No, we don't really think like that because we know that they're just condensed. It's condensed vapor, et cetera, right? So yeah, it takes a lot of work and years of immersion to kind of get to a point where, to use E.D. Hirsch's language, we share type with the author. We share worldview with him, and we can, and only then can we really understand what they're trying to get across. And that's when metaphors really jump out at us.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. So to back up a little bit, then you're saying there are authors who intend to embed types or write in typological fashion. So reading literally is reading according to the literary form, and you're finding in this text a type. Maybe you could explain what you understand a type to be for listeners who might not be familiar with that terminology.
Okay, great. I'm going to give you an explicit example. Deuteronomy 18:15, Moses says, "A prophet like me will arise from among you." Okay, so that's Moses saying, "I am a type. The one to come is
because he's saying a prophet like me."
Yes, right. Yes. Okay. So he's saying, if you want to know what the one to come is going to be like, what he's going to do, look at me and what I've done, and that will teach you what he's going to do. Moses isn't the only one. What he does masterfully in the history before himself is he shows a lot of correspondence with these older figures like Adam and Noah and Abraham with himself and with the nation of Israel. It's as if these people live out what Israel does before it happens, right? And why is he doing that? Well, he is patterning. And that's what I would say. If you want a one word kind of synonym for type, it's pattern. It's people, events, institutions that do the same things or have the same sequence in different texts or at different times. So if in the book of Genesis, there are three births from barrenness, there's Isaac, and then there's Jacob and Esau, and then there's Joseph. So there's a sense in which all three of them are types. They're a pattern. They're each installments in this typological pattern of birth from barrenness. And the repetition ought to cause us to say as readers, this is significant. What is Moses trying to teach us through this birth from barrenness repetition? And again, Moses isn't making this up. He's highlighting a historical reality and using it to serve his literary and theological ends in how he's writing out the story of the first five books of the Bible. So patterning is a big one. Here's another example. God tells, or in Genesis 1, when God creates humanity, he tells the first human couple, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it, and etc. And then after the flood in Genesis chapter 9, he tells Noah the exact same thing, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, etc. That right there is patterning. that what we're supposed to take away from that, and it's very explicit, it's virtually a quotation, is, okay, Noah is now in the place of Adam. He is a new Adam in a sense, right? And you can run that all the way through to Romans chapter 5 and 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul makes it clear that Jesus is the final Adam, the first man and the second or last man. And they correspond to each other in that way. And there's lots of Adams in between, but there they would be the two main ones. And so does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And then, you know, for the be fruitful and multiply illustration, you have that with Adam and then Noah. And then when you open the book of Exodus, the first thing that you hear is similar terminology describing Israel. So
that's right.
Say there's another installation in this pattern. And it sounds to me like you're saying Moses, as he's primarily the author of the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, he could have, if he was just looking to write about history in any way, he could have talked about these things in very different ways. He has a ton of options of how he could describe Israel's history. But he detected in the history of Israel these kind of patterns, and then he used certain ways of framing it in his language and in the form of the structure of a text, maybe, to indicate he thinks that there's a pattern going on there, and readers should expect to see that pattern unfold in increasingly intense ways as it leads to the fulfillment, we might say, of that type or that pattern. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Dr. Hamilton's thesis in his book on typology is that the Genesis 3:15 promise, which is spoken to the serpent, interestingly, that the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent, basically shapes, he calls it promise shape patterns, it shapes anticipation for the rest of the Old Testament for the one to come. Okay, so in other words, the whole Old Testament is anticipatory in nature. It's looking ahead to the redemption that God promised there in the garden in the beginning, immediately following the fall. And so that's a posture, I think, that we want to acknowledge and allow to shape how we read the Old Testament, is that it is anticipatory, intentionally so, which is another kind of aspect of typology. Why is there patterning in the Bible? Well, because we're headed to a culmination. And escalation in significance is an important part of typology. That is, as you move through time and approach the antitype, the final, the culmination, we get an increase in intensity or significance, and again, ultimately arriving at Jesus himself.
Okay, so then as you continue to read the Bible, have you considered other third day connections to resurrection typology? You know, I was just thinking, I think the last time I read through the book of Luke, I was noticing, or Luke and Acts, I was noticing there's a lot of third day stuff there that, or third things, you know, maybe not even a day, like Eutychus falling from the third floor. You know, should we be looking for resurrection significance in every instance like that? And what are the limits maybe as we think about third day connections to resurrection typology?
Great question. So it's very easy to kind of run off the edge or jump in the deep end here with this stuff. And we can start to see things, you might say, that are not intended by the author. So the third is a good example of this. So not every time you come across the number three or the ordinate third in the Bible, it doesn't automatically mean, oh, here we go, this is a resurrection anticipation or something like that. Or in the New Testament, oh, this has something to do with the fact that Jesus rose on the third day, because it's just a number, okay? It's very common. And so there'd have to be other contextual clues that would indicate, oh, no, the author does intend us to, this is an allusion, or he wants to evoke in our minds this particular thing that happened or we expect to happen. A good example of this would be in Genesis 22, when Abraham and Isaac, he's received the command to sacrifice his son, and he arises early the next morning, and they arrive at Moria on the third day. And that's the day when the ram caught in the thicket takes the place of Isaac. And it is a kind of reversal, because Isaac was marked for death and was laying on the altar about to be slain, and he was saved. Again, he didn't die and come back to life, but there's a sense in which we ought to take that as a resurrection from death, because you might say the moment God said, you're going to sacrifice your son, he's as good as dead. And 3 days later, he comes down from the mountain alive. Abraham even says, I and the boy will go and worship on the mountain, and we will return to you. which I think is why the author of Hebrews in chapter 11, you know, he says Abraham believed that God would raise him from the dead. And Paul says that in Romans 4 as well.
Yeah, I like that. I think that makes sense. And it raises another question related to interpretation, which is, can there be multiple types featuring at the same time? So thinking of that text in particular, you know, I think it's easy to see this resurrection typology with Isaac, and we could maybe even make further correspondences. He's the one promised son, these sorts of things. But then also, you can read sermons throughout church history where there's emphasis on the ram as the substitute. So are there multiple typological things going on in a single text, or is that, in your view, kind of merging into applying a typological lens to reading the text instead of identifying typologies that are authorially intended in the text?
Yeah, I would say that in that specific example, I'm not sure that I would call the... So in other words, the way I understand your question is Isaac in his person types Jesus in resurrection. The ram types Jesus as the substitutionary sacrifice.
I think that's kind of a question. Okay. Can those two things happen at the same time?
Okay. So number one, I would say that yes, you know, the biblical authors are highly skilled writers, and they're capable of employing multiple literary devices on top of one another. Genesis 22 absolutely teaches substitutionary sacrifice. It's very explicit about that, how the ram takes the place of Isaac. I mean, Abraham even tells him before they're at the top that the Lord will provide for himself a burnt offering, right? So yeah, I mean, I think the ram, again, hear the story as an Israelite who has been participating in the sacrificial cult for 40 years walking in the wilderness, right? And you hear that story and you're like, oh, of course. This is what goes on at the tabernacle every day on my behalf. Right? That hits. And it hits less for us because, again, sacrifice isn't a part of our everyday life. We're not super familiar with Leviticus and Numbers and some of these things about the law. And so there's a plug to make sure that we read and are familiar with Leviticus. So I think that the idea of substitution is definitely patterned there, and it, from a textual perspective, it anticipates the substitutionary nature of the sacrificial system. But again, in reality, Moses lives that, and he is highlighting it in the story that he's writing about things that happened a long time ago. And he's doing that on purpose to connect it to the Israelites' own experience and what he's written about the sacrificial system in Leviticus. And in that way, all of the sacrifices of animals anticipate the one final sacrifice. And you know, the author of Hebrews gets into that in Hebrews 8 through 10. So yeah, I would affirm that. Again, and what I would say is, so there have been many abuses in church history of typology where great authors like Augustine and Origen and many of these people, they're devoted and they're reading the Bible closely, but they're adding things to the text that are not intended by the author. And that's okay. There's also, you know, contemporary examples of this, like kind of more popular pastoral authors like, say, Arthur Pink. He loved the Joseph story. And, you know, he'll argue things like, well, you know, there was a baker and a cupbearer in the prison with Joseph, and that's the bread and wine of the Lord's Supper. No, that's probably not the point. It'd be really hard to defend that. And so one of the things I learned from Dr. Hamilton is if you think something is typological in the Old Testament, especially in what Moses wrote, you want to see it interpreted by later authors. We'd love to see it interpreted by a New Testament author, right? That's very helpful. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be, but you want to see it interpreted by later authors to some degree. It's a lot harder to defend a particular typology in the text if you don't really have anything to go on later on. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah, I think that makes sense, and that's helpful. So I want to ask two follow-up questions to that. So I think most people, when they hear the term expositional preaching, they're thinking you're preaching the main point of the passage. So when it comes to narratives in particular, but especially narratives like this Akedah text, where you do have a substitute sacrifice image and as you're arguing, a resurrection typology. How do you preach both of those things? Are they separate points in a text or different emphases? What do you do with a narrative like that if you're preaching that text?
So I would argue that the main point of Genesis 22 would have to do with, or something more to do with, God's confirmation of his covenant with Abraham as a result of his faithful obedience. So earlier in chapter 15, you have Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. So Abraham is, according to Paul, Abraham is justified at that point. And now his justification, or his faith in the word of God, works itself out in obedience, imperfect, that culminates in his willingness to sacrifice his son. I think that that's probably the main point. Now, connected to that is the point that substitutionary sacrifice results in life. And that's how I would connect the two. So they're not really separate. What you want to make the connection between is that the death of a substitutionary sacrifice means life for me. And the sense in which it's resurrection life has to do with the fact that when Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden after the fall, that was their death. It was exile. They were specific text. The Hebrew text says that they were disinherited. That's how I would define the word that's used. They were disinherited from the garden, and they were outside of the place of life and no longer had access to the tree of life. And so there's a sense in which they were dead when they were outside. And that idea gets picked up is taught by Moses himself regarding the future exile of Israel, and then gets picked up significantly in the prophets. Many people are familiar with the Valley of Dry Bones, which is a picture of exiled Israel and then them coming back to life, which is a picture of restoration from exile. It's resurrection from death. And so the whole goal of the Bible, you might say, is to restore Edenic fellowship between God and man, which is why the New Jerusalem in Revelation has the tree of life in it. It's restoring, but even in a heightened way, what we had in Eden and what we lost. So to be alive is, in a sense, to return to Eden. And yeah, so there's a whole, we could run down this forever, but again, we're talking at the worldview level with imagery and symbolism and things like that. So connecting substitutionary sacrifice to life, to restoration of life. I live because this happened for me. Again, that hits for the Israelite reader who participates in every day. It hits for us because we know that because of the cross and Jesus's victory over death and the resurrection, we not only are justified as Abraham was through faith, but we look forward to the culmination of that in resurrection, eternal life.
Yeah. Your engagement with the text is a little bit more grounded than simply saying Abraham represents God, Isaac represents Jesus until he doesn't, because then the ram represents Jesus. So, you know, that would be maybe a flaky or unhelpful way of trying to identify and understand the typological image there.
Yes.
And instead, you're looking for us to pay closer attention to the text, identify the patterns, and then maybe be not a minimalist, but definitely not a maximalist in just assigning meaning to every kind of image we might see.
We want to ground every interpretive assertion in a feature of the text. Now, so let me say something about the father-son thing, because it is significant. Right at the beginning of the passage, God says to him, "Your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac." That strung out identification of Isaac is significant, and we ought to pick up on that. And the fact that the father is sacrificing the son is also significant. And that's because, I argue this in another publication of mine, Adam, the first man, is a son of God. And Luke calls him that at the end of his genealogy of Jesus in Luke 3. But that's not why. Luke is interpreting Genesis, just like I'm about to say, or I'm following Luke, you might say. He's not following me. And the point is, the idea is, if you read Genesis 5 at the beginning when Seth is born, the Bible says that Adam fathered Seth in his image and likeness. Okay. And that's how God created the first man in Genesis chapter 1, according to his image and his likeness. And so the idea is that creation according to image and likeness and fathering are the same thing, that God fathered Adam when he made him. And so Adam is a son of God. And then Israel is called the Son of God in Exodus 4:23. And this, I call it the Son of God type. Jesus obviously is the culmination of it, but also in the Davidic covenant, which I just taught last night at church, in 2 Samuel 7, God says, the seed of David, I will be a father to him and he will be a son to me, right? So in other words, he's going to be like Adam, who was the my first son, and like Israel, who was my son in a collective sense. So the seed to come, the one to come, will be a son of God, like Adam, and like Isaac is a son of Abraham, again, who was born from barrenness and et cetera. And like Israel is with respect to God. Yeah. So I wouldn't mute that. I think that there is contextual significance to that. And what it shows, again, is that what Moses wrote is just plumbing the depths of it takes a lot of time and attention. And it's worth it. And I like to say, and maybe someday I can prove it, that everything in the Bible starts in what Moses wrote. I mean, he is the paradigmatic prophet. A prophet like me will arise from among you. And he wrote a significant composition as a result of, at least primarily, his face-to-face interaction with the Lord. He starts all the typological trajectories that the later biblical authors pick up on and claim that are fulfilled in the Lord Jesus. And those are the things we want to try to pay attention to. And why does this matter? Because it helps us to see who Jesus is, and it helps us to better understand the content of the gospel when we can see what were the people of God being taught and told ahead of time, what to expect, what is going to happen for you in the future. That helps us better understand Jesus himself, his work, what the New Testament authors wrote, and what it means for us as believers today.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm inclined to agree as well that what Moses did is kind of the foundation for everything that follows. And I think the more we attend to the way the Old Testament uses the Old Testament, the more we can see that. And then again, with the New. Now, when Paul is talking about Christ's resurrection according to the third day, how can we be certain that his line according to the scriptures includes Genesis 1? You know, I think it's pretty evident that Paul's a careful reader of the Bible. He's obviously given a lot of attention to the Adam and Christ typology in Romans 5 and 1 Corinthians 15, perhaps, with the image of the heavenly man and the dustly man. But is there anything else, or what would your argument be that Paul has picked up on the same connection between third day and seed that you've picked up on?
So I would go back to what I said earlier, which is his grounding is the scriptures. And so it would appear to me that he's drawing on a typological thread that runs throughout the Old Testament, right? And so if he wanted to point to a specific text, then he would have said it, I think. He's not leaving it to us to try to figure out what particular passage are you talking about. He's talking about a typological trajectory that begins somewhere and then is interpreted by later authors, and that is observable to readers like himself. And in accordance with what I said earlier, that Moses, the paradigmatic prophet, inaugurates every type that there is in the Bible, in the Pentateuch, in the first five books. I'm going to look there. I'm going to try to see what does Moses say about this, if he says anything. My argument is just basically that resurrection typology runs throughout the Pentateuch. It's a feature of his composition from the beginning all the way to the end. So I wouldn't try to say, no, Paul is definitely drawing on Genesis 1. I'm saying he's drawing on a resurrection typology in the Old Testament that begins in what Moses wrote. And if we observe what Moses wrote, the resurrection typology in the Pentateuch begins in the creation narrative.
Yeah, very good. So then that seed typology that begins in the creation narrative, it seems like that seed metaphor, you know, there's a concrete meaning of the term that seems to be applied more abstractly, but related to this promised seed of the woman. And I wonder sometimes, could there be alternative explanations? You know, I think every time we're testing an interpretation like this, you want to think of alternatives. Is it possible that the seed terminology is used to picture the woman's womb as the ground or something like that, instead of saying this guy will do what seeds do, which is go into the ground and then come up? Does that question make sense?
Yes, it does. And I think that that's true. I think we ought to think about the woman's womb as a metaphorical ground, which again sets up birth from barrenness. It sets up imagery in, say, Isaiah 40 through 55 that depicts exiled Israel and the desolate land in parallel, and then the restoration of both also in parallel. So the land will become fruitful again. In fact, in 51 verse 3, Isaiah says that the land will be like the garden of the Lord. And that the people, the post-exilic people, will be so many that you have to stretch the tents out in Isaiah 54, right? And the expectation in like Isaiah 33, 17, that not only will we see the king in his beauty, the seed himself, but we will see a land that stretches afar. So, and as far as what else seed might mean, what I think is significant is that in the early creation narratives, so Genesis 1 through 3, the word is only used to refer to vegetation and human offspring, right? So as far as what else could it mean? I mean, it's an agricultural term. There's no debate about that. The question in my mind is, why use an agricultural term for humans when there's plenty of terms that you could use for a human child?
Mm-hmm.
Moses didn't have to use zerah. He could have used several other Hebrew terms that refer to human children or sons or whatever. And so that a choice like that appears to be on purpose. Now, you know, I guess maybe you could say, well, maybe it's just the fact that plants and humans both procreate. They both multiply. But I don't know. I think that seems kind of empty. Like, what's the point of that?
Yeah.
What would be the point?
Yeah, it does seem like the terminology for the next generation is important to pay attention to, because you do have this first, you know, the seed of the woman. And I think it's interesting that it's the woman's seed that's talked about there, because that's a bit unusual, I think. And then when Cain is born, he's called a man. So, and then I think, you know, in Lamech's even kind of song about retaliation, there's another term for a young child there. So it does seem like Moses had multiple terms he could have used. And there are a couple of instances where he uses something that surprises us and calls our attention to it. And I think maybe that's kind of what you're getting at, is seed is something that's surprising that he used when he has other more natural terms he could have used.
Yeah, I mean, the connection between humans and plants or trees is really pervasive, not just in Moses, but in the prophets as well. It really is.
Isaiah.
And I mean, so for like an example is in Numbers 24, Balaam is on the mountain with Balak and he's observing Israel, and Balak wants him to curse them. And what comes out of his mouth is blessing repeatedly. And in one instance, he looks at Israel and he sees a beautiful garden. So that's an example. And it's metaphorical. These 2 million people or whatever, they look like a well-watered and well and healthy, lush garden, which is Edenic imagery, right? Like Eden. And then there's things in the prophets, things like Isaiah says that, you know, the people of God will be like oaks of righteousness, right? That we will be like big, strong trees planted in the ground, immovable. It's pervasive. And which just, again, what it does is it adds, it better defends what I'm arguing for, which is a worldview level connection, metaphorical connection between people and seeds, especially trees and seed bearing plants. So yeah, it's not the kind of thing we're making up. It's very observable. And the question is, why are the biblical authors doing this? And again, my argument, it has to do with how Jesus interprets it in John 12.
Yeah.
I'm kind of, you might say, following him.
Yep. Yeah. Well, I'm inclined to agree with what you're writing in this article. So as time is escaping here, just a couple of quick follow-up questions. One would be, if Moses is making a connection between seed and third day resurrection, which I think he is, and between seed and humanity, should we be understanding him to say that the woman's seed would experience death? So in other words, should we take the heel wound in Genesis 3:15 as fatal? I think John Walton argues perhaps that we should imagine a venomous snake that wounds the woman's offspring. And I, you know, the more that I've reflected on, if we're to understand this offspring, this seed, as going into the ground, it would make sense to view a fatal wound there. How do you interpret that division between the head wound and the heel wound in Genesis 3:15?
I think that's good. I think the thrust of the statement is the comparison between the two, So you have the heel wound and then the head crushing. And so I think if we want to call the heel wound fatal, it's not final like the head crushing would be. If we want to call them both fatal, there's a difference in degree, and which, you know, perhaps sets up resurrection, right? So he's going to die, but that's not final. He's going to rise again. But the serpent, the head wound to the serpent is final. There is no life for him afterwards. I mean, I'd go along those lines, but yeah, I think that that's fine. I think the comparison between the two is really the thrust of it.
Yeah, it is interesting that it's the woman's seed and the serpent that are engaged in this instead of the serpent's seed, which you would expect given the way that verse unfolds. So final question for you. This guy, Todd Patterson, identifies this promise in Genesis 3:15 about the seed of the woman as central to the plot structure of Genesis. And maybe even to the whole Bible. Do you agree with that? And a very brief moment, could you outline how that plot structure unfolds in Genesis and maybe even to Jesus? Elevator yes. speech.
I do agree, and so would Dr. Hamilton. And so essentially, the promise is that a human offspring is going to reverse what happened in the garden, which is sin followed by death. So we should understand what our hope should be is that there's going to be a human offspring in the future who is going to remove sin and guilt and shame and restore life. And then so the main picture of this in the Old Testament is the nation of Israel, both in their Exodus. So when they go down into Egypt and then come out through not only under the Passover lamb's blood, but also through the waters of the Red Sea, and then also in their future exile and restoration from exile, which is followed by what Moses calls heart circumcision in Deuteronomy 30. That's kind of the main picture of what the seed's victory over the serpent is going to look like. Okay, it's going to be remove sin, heart circumcision, and it's going to be restoration to life. That's a place of life, an Edenic kind of place. And so in the Lord Jesus, we have a regeneration by the Holy Spirit through faith in him. And we have the promise of the new heavens and the new earth, which we will inherit when he returns.
Wow. Very good. Well, I think that what you've written in this article is helpful for us as we learn how to read the Bible and learn to read according to the literary forms and features laid out by the biblical authors. So thanks for writing it, but then taking the time to talk through it here with us. Is there anything you're working on or that you'd want members at our church to be aware of as you keep pursuing this kind of thinking?
Sure. So next month, I'll go to the Evangelical Theological Society's annual meeting, which is for, you know, it's Christian scholarship. And I'm giving a presentation to answer the question. The theme of the conference is the Council of Nicaea. So I'm giving a presentation in a group of presentations answering the question, do the Old Testament authors anticipate incarnation in the Messiah, right? And I'm arguing in the affirmative, and I'm focusing on the Pentateuch, on what Moses wrote. And my main example or object of inquiry is Moses himself and his shining face in Exodus 34.
Okay.
So yeah, that's what I'm saying. And it's a fascinating topic. But it's also challenging because the temptation, again, there's always a temptation to read into, and we want to avoid that and make sure that the things we're saying are text-based. And so I'm working on that and looking forward to hearing feedback on it next month.
Very good. Well, I'll be in attendance, so hopefully I'll be able to sit in and hear you present that presentation. Well,
yeah, it'd be good to meet you in person.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. And for our listeners, if you have questions about this, I'm happy to talk with you, or I'm sure if you send in an email with questions, particularly for Tom, perhaps I can pass those on to him as well. Well, this podcast is a ministry of Resurrection Church in Burnsville, Minnesota. You can join us in person on any Sunday or learn about us online at any time.